All right, so we've got quite a bit to cover this morning. We're starting in Acts 23, verse 12, and we need to make it through Acts 25, verse 12 this morning. So we can do it. You're laughing. We're going to get there. I love this part of the book of Acts. This is, it's just such an action-packed sequence here. Right? I mean, this is, it's really getting exciting. It's like, it reads like a novel, but it's true. This is nonfiction, and it is really just a lot's going on here. It's exciting stuff. So let's recap a little bit and talk about how we got to this place. So again, we're going to pick up in 23:12. But where is Paul? 23:12, where is he? What city? Jerusalem? Okay. How did he come to be in Jerusalem? What was he doing before he was in Jerusalem? He was finishing up the, which one? The third missionary journey, right? So at the conclusion of the third missionary journey, he says, I need to go to Jerusalem, and I understand that I'm headed to Rome. So he's in Jerusalem now. This is where he knew he was going to be. He's in Jerusalem, and what's he doing right now? As we pick up in 23:12, from where we left off on Wednesday, what is he doing right now?
The
nation of Jerusalem, right? Or the Judeans, right? So he's enjoying the hospitality of the leadership of the Jewish people. What had he gone there to do? What was he doing when he was arrested in the temple? Well, I mean, but even before that, what's that? He was keeping a vow, and he was trying to help four other men to complete their probably Nazarite vow. So, I mean, he was trying to act in good faith towards his Jewish heritage and his Jewish religion. He was trying to serve God, and he was interrupted. He was prevented from finishing his 7 days of purification because they came and arrested him. Although he wasn't really doing anything. I mean, he wasn't even really teaching. I have a hard time thinking he was probably teaching. But, I mean, he doesn't seem to have been stirring up any kind of crowd or any kind of drama. He was just in the temple trying to complete a vow, trying to help four other guys complete a vow, trying to be a Jew and be a Christian. And they came and arrested him, beat him up. And who saved Paul from the beating that he was receiving at the hands of the Jewish leaders? Yeah, commander, or the ESV calls him a tribune. Tribune. What's a tribune? What branch of the Roman government would the tribune in this case have been serving? We may have talked about this maybe briefly. The tribune would have been high-ranking soldier in the Roman army, right? So as the organization of the Roman army went, there would have been, like, the largest unit of the army was a legion, and that was 4,200 to 5,500 men. And within the legion, there would have been about five or six tribunes. So a tribune would have been responsible for probably around 600 or 800 men. He was a man of great responsibility, and he would have had several centurions under him. Usually six centuries were responsible to one tribute. So a century, of course, we call a century, that's the word used for 100 years. It just means 100. And it would have been 80 to 100 men per century in the Roman army. So this tribune was a significant man. He had authority over a lot of soldiers. And what was his responsibility in the region? What would a tribune have been doing? Keeping the peace. Yeah. What do you not want happening if you're the tribune in Jerusalem? Yeah, rioting, not so good, right? I mean, rioting, uproar, uprising, sedition, like trying to supplant local or regional or Roman government, those things would be looked down upon. So this guy, I mean, he's charged with keeping the peace. Let's keep things moving and working smoothly in Jerusalem. Well, it's not working out right now, right? So Paul is getting beat up by the Jews, and so the tribune charges into the crowd with a couple of centurions and rescues Paul from the crowd. And Paul, what does Paul say? Now Paul he's still in the crowd, but he's now under some protection, and they're kind of headed into the barracks, and what does Paul want to do? Paul wants to talk, right? He wants to speak to the crowd. And he's preaching the gospel. He's telling about his conversion. And he gets them really riled up by telling them that he was also sent to the Gentiles. They just can't take that. And so the tribune says, well, we got to figure this out. Let's just do what? What's the tribune want to do? Yeah, let's examine him. And so examination with the whip would have been, we discussed on Wednesday, a very unfortunate event. It might have led to Paul's death. And so as Paul is stretched out, ready to receive his beating, Paul says, what? By the way, I'm a citizen of Rome. Is that a problem? And the centurion goes back to the tribune and says, what are you about to do? Did you know this guy's a Roman citizen? And that kind of brings things to a stop. He doesn't get his flogging. And so what audience does Paul find himself before next? So first it's this crowd in the temple. And, you know, he's being taken to the barracks. There's a crowd at the doorstep of the barracks. And now Paul's in custody of the tribune. And he has a new audience. Who's the audience in 22 verse 30? Yeah, there's the council, probably the Sanhedrin council. And in attendance, all the ranking members of the Jewish leadership, the high priests, two major sects are present. Who do we have? The Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so how did Paul win in the council? Win? I mean, he he didn't lose. Divide and conquer, yeah. He set the Pharisees and the Sadducees at odds. How? That's right. He says, you know, it's concerning the resurrection from the dead that I'm on trial here today. And then, of course, the Pharisees who believe in the resurrection and the Sadducees who don't believe in the resurrection are now infighting. And they've kind of forgotten that they've got a mutual enemy. Now they're enemies of each other. And the Pharisees finally stand up for Paul. And this strange thing happens where all these people who were gathered together to accuse Paul, now they can't decide on who the bad guy really is. And the Pharisees are saying, well, maybe he's not that bad after all. He could have actually been receiving instructions. You know, maybe he's God's messenger after all. And so Paul's brought back to the barracks, and what does the Lord reaffirm to Paul? What's going on here? Is this just random happening, or 23:11? That's right. So Paul knows, and he has been told this already in the Spirit, and the Lord reaffirms to him in 23:11, Paul, you're headed to Rome. This is part of the plan. And so I think that would have brought great comfort, knowing that, you know, this is all not a whole lot of fun for Paul. He's on trial. He's been beaten. He's been threatened. Worse beatings. He is under some duress here, but the Lord is affirming to him, this is where I want you. This is what you need to be doing. And so that brings us to today's lesson in 23:12. So I felt like we kind of needed to go back a little bit and just talk about how we got here, because all of those details are pertinent to where we find Paul right now. Would someone read 12 through 15? Okay, so we have a plot against Paul. And who is fomenting this plot? Who's doing it? Is this the council? It's not the council. It's not the high priest. So who is bringing this plot against Paul? It's a group of assassins. Yeah, I don't think that they were anyone in particular. It doesn't mention if they were. It was just a group of zealous Jews who decide on this plot, and they bring this plot to the leadership and say, here's what we want to do. We want to kill Paul. We're not going to eat or drink until we've done it. And so we want you to go and seek for him to be brought into the council again. And on his way to the council, we're all going to attack him and kill him. So given that this isn't the council acting, I do wonder, I mean, have we heard wisdom from the council before? I mean, this is the Sanhedrin council has, you know, the council now has this plot before them. And it seems that they're willing. It wasn't necessarily their idea, but they're willing to engage in this plot against Paul. What do you think? I mean, Acts 5, we see the council. And in verses 35 through 39, Gamaliel brings a caution to the council. And he says, men of Israel, take care what you're about to do with these men. And he proceeds to tell them, you know, it may be that they're from God, or it may be that they're fraudulent. But why don't you be careful what you do? Because if they are from God, then we may be opposing God. And if they are fraudulent, then they will fail. So, I mean, there was some wisdom in the council. And it seems that the council heeded words of wisdom. In Acts 23, the same chapter here, verse 9, the scribes and Pharisees said, we find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? So, you know, just in the preceding passage, we have some wisdom in the council. Although it was in this stage of infighting between the Pharisees and Sadducees, granted, their reasoning was all questionable, but still, there was some wisdom coming out of the council. And here, we have the council, the same council, in the same situation, and they've succumbed to some really terrible advice. They've engaged in this plan to murder a man. All right. Would someone read 16 through 22? Actually, let's stop in verse 19, 16 through 19. All right, that's interesting. Do you find anything remarkable about Paul's relationship with the centurions and the tribune? Yeah, he's kind of telling them what to do, right? I mean, he gives an instruction to the centurion, and the centurion does what he says. I think that's probably kind of abnormal for a centurion and a tribune to be taking instructions from a prisoner. I would propose that there are probably at least two different reasons why the centurions and the tribune are open ears to what Paul has to say. What do you think? What might be contributing to the Roman soldiers' leadership listening to Paul? For sure. So Paul, being a Roman citizen, they're kind of in legally murky waters as it is, because they almost flogged a Roman citizen, and they had him bound, and they've still got him as a prisoner. So they have a Roman citizen as prisoner in their prison, in their barracks, and they don't really have any good charges. They're not really sure that they have the legal grounds to keep him prisoner, right? So they're in... They're in a precarious situation here legally. I think it's also pretty obvious. I think the second reason I can see here is that it's pretty obvious to them that Paul's innocent. I mean, they've heard both sides of this at this point, and there's just there's not a whole lot of sense not a whole lot of reason or rational thought coming from his accusers. I think that they can see that the Jews are being unreasonable here, and I think that they may be kind of impressed with Paul's character. It seems like if Paul had been adversarial to them, or if he had been ornery, if he had been an unlikable person, I think it might have been easier for them to neglect him or to treat him poorly. But he seems to be treated relatively well. So when Paul's nephew comes with something to say, the centurion and the tribune are very interested indeed. What is it that you have to tell me? So let's continue. Would someone read 20 through 22? So what's the message? What message does Paul's nephew bring? It's a trap. Yeah, I mean, speaking of sedition, I mean, we haven't quite gotten there, but they're about to accuse Paul of sedition. And here we've got the Jewish leadership engaging in sedition. I mean, they are about to try to overthrow the legal process of the local Roman government to kill a prisoner on his way to be examined by the council. And Paul's nephew brings a warning of this situation to the tribune. What does the tribune do? What's his response? Well, you know, the first thing he does in verse 22 is he sends the kid away, right? I mean, I love this in the way that it reads, because I really like the pause in verse 22, because if I didn't know how this story ended, would you have just a little bit of anxiety about the outcome here? I mean, the commander sends the young man away and says, "Tell no one that you've informed me of these things." Ooh, what's he going to do? Is he going to go along with the plot? Is he going to try to protect Paul? Is he going to take this seriously? Well, we don't know. We don't know whether the tribune will act on this, right? So we pick up in verse 23. Would someone read 23 through 30? That's it. Thank you. So what's the tribune's response? What does he do?
He sends it up to the chain, the next guy in charge. He
does. And how does he do it?
With a letter.
With a letter and
pretty big force of
protection. A lot of protection. He sends a small army with Paul. He sends 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, and 70 horsemen. And what does he? How does he send Paul? At night and on a horse. He's not just. I don't think he's just doing this because he has to. I think that he's really taking Paul seriously here. I mean, he really has Paul's best interest at heart. Maybe because he's a Roman citizen and he doesn't want to bear the consequences of letting this man die. But maybe there's more to it. He really has some respect for Paul as well. He doesn't just send him on foot. He sends Paul on a horse and says, make sure this man gets there safe. 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, and 70 horsemen. That's 470 men. That is a lot of soldiers. That's an entire cohort of soldiers. A cohort was about 480 soldiers in the Roman army. And in a legion, there would have been about 10 cohorts. And remember, the tribune is one of five tribunes probably in a legion. So the tribune would have had probably two cohorts under his control, right? So if the tribune has two cohorts and he sends one whole cohort with Paul to Caesarea, that's impressive. I mean, that leaves his position indefensible in Jerusalem, right? I mean, he was probably supposed to have two cohorts with him in Jerusalem to uphold the law, to ensure regional peace and safety. And he sent a whole cohort with Paul up the road. I think it's remarkable. And he didn't just, again, he didn't just send him with force for protection, but gave specific instructions for how he was to be transported on the way and how he was to be presented with the letter. So where and to whom does Lysias, the tribune, plan to send Paul? He's going to send him to what city? I think I just said it. To Caesarea, which is what? Why Caesarea? It's the capital of Judea. So the Roman region of Judea. Caesarea is the capital. It's a coastal capital in on the north coast of the Mediterranean Sea in the region of Judea. So he plans to send him to Caesarea because why? Why is he sending him to the capital? Who's in the capital? Felix, the governor. The governor of Judea is in Caesarea. So he's sending him to the capital to go to the audience of the governor of Judea. And what was Lysias' reasoning? I mean, aside from the fact that there's this huge plot to kill Paul, what reasoning does he have for transporting Paul to Felix? Verse 29. What's he done? Yeah. Yeah, it's a matter of, the conflict between Paul and the Jews seems to be a matter of Jewish law. Paul has done nothing to deserve imprisonment or death. So, I mean, he's got this prisoner with no valid charges, and he's like, I'm not really sure what to do with this. And then the plot, of course, had been made against him. And finally, he decided to send him to Felix just to consider Paul's case. How? Was Felix going to consider Paul's case in isolation, or just Paul's word, or what? How does the tribune want to present Paul to Felix? In what audience? Verse 30, second half. He wants the Jews to be there also. He's going to do this the right way. He wants to give Paul a fair trial before Felix, the governor. Ordering his accusers also to state before him, or before you, what they have against him. All right, would somebody read 31 through 35? Yes, sir. Yeah, go ahead.
I see it a little different. Mm-hmm. That this guy was trying to wash his hands of the situation, pass it up to the next guy, and if you read this letter carefully, I is in there about four or five times. He's wanting to project himself as positive influence in all this, because he might be the next in line. And so I think he was doing all he could do to make himself look good and pass this decision on to somebody else, because had he made a decision in favor of the Jews, it would have been bad for the Roman government, and
Yeah, that's a fair point. So the Tribune definitely has two competing interests here, right? I mean, he's definitely interested in making the Jews happy because he is supposed to be promoting peace in the region. But he is also interested in protecting Paul because he has a responsibility to a Roman citizen. And so he's got these competing interests. And I think you're right. I think he is trying to paint himself in a fairly glowing portrait here, that he doesn't want to be seen as having failed in any particular way at maintaining the peace in the region. But yeah, his intentions are not entirely clear. Sonny? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a fair argument to be made in either way here, that you know he may or may not have had Paul's best interest in mind. We really don't know from the context. I made some inferences from the way that he treated Paul in putting him on a horse and you know saying make sure he gets there safely. But you know there's also a good argument to be made that he probably doesn't have a very high opinion of Christians and of Paul in general. But regardless, Sonny, you make a good point that God is acting behind the scenes here and orchestrating the sequence that's about to occur. God is making sure that his will is going to be done. And what is God's will for Paul? That he is headed to Rome, right? So we see that everyone who is participating in this story is ultimately accomplishing God's plan for Paul here. So, real quick, and then we're moving on. Yeah. Agreed. Yep. It's hard to say for sure. So, okay, one more.
Rescued
him, yeah.
After you were about to scourge him and do something that was highly illegal against the mother.
He neglected to mention that one point of fact. All right. Let's carry on to chapter 24. Would someone be willing to read 1 through 9? Okay, so the Jews sent someone with their, you know, with the high priests, with the leadership. They sent someone to plead their case in the court of law. This man, Tertullus, he seems to be a lawyer. He has he's educated in the formalities of the Roman court. And how does he address Felix, the governor? Ooh, he's a smooth talker. He he's really buttering him up here, isn't he? I mean, he's laying it on thick. He's like, you know, we really love everything you're doing with the place. You're doing great work. We don't have anything bad to say about you at all. Thank you so much for who you are. And by the way, we've got this guy that we really don't like, right? So what does he accuse Paul of? What does he call him? A pest or a plague. And that's kind of an attention getter, right? I mean, nobody likes a plague. So, he's probably got his Felix's attention here, like, oh, he's a plague. Well, that doesn't sound good. We should do something about that. What else does he say about him? He's one who stirs up dissensions or riots among all the Jews throughout the world. Boy, that's a big claim, right? So what was Felix's job as governor? Keep the peace, kind of like the commander. I mean, they have the same charge, right? They're supposed to keep the peace in the region. And rioting was not looked upon fondly, right? That would have been a sign of failure of the governor to keep the peace. Okay, so what else do they say about him? He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Well, Nazarenes, well, where's that come from? Jesus of Nazareth. Well, he probably doesn't want to call them Christians, right? Because that would almost be endorsing the idea that Jesus was the Christ, the Messiah. And that would be going too much into the religious dissension that they had with him. So these are the Nazarenes. These are the followers of Jesus of Nazareth. This is just, what did he call them? He called them a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So Paul being a ringleader and them being a sect of Nazarenes suggests not only that Paul was a troublemaker, he was a rioter, but he's also a seditious rebel, right? He's trying to foment rebellion against the emperor. That's kind of the idea that I think he's trying to plant here, a ringleader. And this would have been a real attention getter for the governor, right? Because you really don't want Caesar to hear about your region as being the source of a rebellion. So I think that he's really laying it on thick. You're trying to appeal to everything the governor cares about in trying to get Paul condemned. And finally, he says he tried to profane the temple. And Caesar and Felix would have cared about that also, because, again, in the name of keeping the peace in the region, you want to make the people happy, right? You want to keep the people satisfied with the government. And if your government is allowing some guy from somewhere to come and profane the temple, to disrespect the local religion, that's also not good for peace. So he's got all these points trying to appeal to the governor to condemn Paul. And how does this all play out? Would someone read verses 10 through 21?
Verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or the city. Neither can I prove to you that they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now, after several years, I came to bring my alms to my nation and present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple, without any crowd or tumult, but some Jews from Asia. They thought they ought to be here before you accusation, should they have anything against me, or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing that I cried out by standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day.
How did Paul address Felix? Come compared to Tertullus? Maybe not quite to the extent, right? But he's still, I mean, verse 10, knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. So the same, a similar respect, probably less dramatic. Like, we love everything you've done here. I mean, he didn't go into all the buttering up, but still very respectful and very, very well spoken in this Roman court. He demonstrates that he is an educated man, that he's able to present a rational defense before, and he gives him the respect of not just spurning, you know, not just having any like ad hominem attacks against his accusers or anything like that. I mean, he's not angry. He's not, you know, there are all these things that he isn't, but he is very respectful and pays the respect to Felix of giving him a very well thought out explanation of his actions. So how did Paul dispute the specific action or accusations against him? He made some direct rebuttals against their claims, right? Points out that he had come to Jerusalem just 12 days earlier. He came to worship. He didn't come to stir things up. He denies that he was causing any kind of dispute or agitation anywhere in the city. I mean, he says that there wasn't even a crowd around him. And finally, he invites his accusers to do what? Prove it. They can't come up with one shred of evidence to support their claims because it's not true. He knows they have none. And how does Paul explain what he was actually doing in Jerusalem? Well, he explains that he serves the same God that they do, right? The same God that these accusers serve. And he believes all the same doctrines from the law and the prophets that these men believe. And he further demonstrates that he was not a riotous man. He calls on them to recall that there was no crowd around him in the temple. He wasn't stirring up any dissent in the temple when they arrested him. He shows his understanding of the law, saying that his accusers, the Jews from Asia, should be there. That his accusers from the Jews from Asia should actually be present in presenting their accusation against him, since they were the ones who got him arrested in the first place. And finally, he wraps up his defense by reminding them that the real reason we're here is that their objection to him saying, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you this day. And this is important because it demonstrates that Paul's conflict between himself and his accusers is not of a Roman legal nature, but of the nature of the religious law that they disagree about. And so it really shouldn't be... It's not something he should be condemned in a Roman court over. In addition to making a defense before Felix, what has Paul done here? He's had the opportunity to preach the gospel before another new audience, right? All right, let's keep going. I'll read 22 through 27. But Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias, the tribune, comes down, I will decide your case. Then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody but have some liberty, and that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. After some days, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you. At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul, so he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So what's Felix's decision towards Paul? Well, first he punts and says, I'll just wait for Lysias, my subordinate, to come, and then we'll make a decision together. And then he gives instructions for Paul's imprisonment to be light, gives him quite a few freedoms. But he's heard the truth now, and his heart was wrong. What did he want from Paul? Money. He wanted money. He was trying to extort Paul for his release. And even when he realized that Paul wasn't going to give him any money, what did he do with Paul? Left him in prison because it would please the Jews. Would someone read 25, 1 through 5? All right. So there's a new governor in town. The new governor is Festus. Felix has been replaced. Festus is here, and he arrives in the region and goes to Jerusalem first, and he is petitioned by the Jews to take care of this guy, Paul, once and for all. And he says, well, I haven't even been to Caesarea, but I'm headed there. And so, go ahead. Oh, yeah, I wondered that, too. I mean, they must be hungry and thirsty, right? I mean, I sort of doubt they had the courage to complete that vow, but I've wondered the same thing, right? I mean, they made a pretty big deal out of this, right? We're not going to eat or drink until this guy's dead. Let me finish this out real quick, and let's get to the punchline of this story. Verse 6, after he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there to be tried on these charges before me? But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews, I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, to Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go. Where is Caesar? In Rome. There we have it. Thank you all.